Now, I didn't have Courtney read our main text for this morning, and she can thank me later. But it's the story of Tamar, and so I guess let's start here. How many of you know the story of Tamar? If you'll just raise your hand for me. A couple of you know the story of Tamar. You know why I didn't have Courtney read the story of Tamar out loud this morning. I forgive you if you don't know the story of Tamar. It's kind of sandwiched in the Joseph story in Genesis. Joseph picks up in kind of Genesis 36 and all the way to the end of the book, and Tamar's story is in Genesis 38. And Andrew Lloyd Webber has not written a musical about Tamar and Judah, again, for reasons we'll see in just a moment. But that's where we're going to begin today, in the story of Tamar. And it's where we're going to begin this series, her story, on the women that Matthew includes in Jesus' genealogy in the first chapter of Matthew. We're going to see that later as well. And this was a really strange thing, that Matthew would lift up women's names in a genealogy, in a family tree, if you will. But he does. And he does lift up these women's names for some very important reasons that we're going to look at over the next few weeks. And we're going to look at it because I think that our society, our culture, is, over the last few months, kind of having a renaissance in our ability to listen and hear the stories of women. And unfortunately, that's another reason why many of us probably don't know the story of Tamar, because oftentimes we don't know a lot of the stories of women even in our own scriptures. But it's a time for us to pick up on this thing that I do think God is doing, and listen to these stories and listen to these experiences, and I hope find how God is speaking to us, both through the Word, the Scriptures, and also how God is moving and speaking to us in the movements of our culture in this moment. I also want to acknowledge before we start this series that as we lift up these women's stories, I'm not a woman. So just put that out there, in case you hadn't noticed. I'm not, and that can be a little awkward because, you know, the stories weren't written by women, and the story isn't being preached by a woman. And so as much as I want to lift up these voices and stories, I can only do that to so far of an extent. And so I'm going to be kind of trying to be creative and finding other ways of doing that, of lifting up women's actual voices and not just having their stories told through mine. And if you feel like you are inspired as a woman in this congregation to share your story in some way, please talk to me, because I would love for that to be a part of this series over the next few weeks. So we'll go from there. But let's dive right in. I couldn't find a good way, an appropriate way, of reading this Genesis 38 publicly. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read through it and comment on it at the same time and kind of use some discretion as to what gets shared. And I would encourage you to go and read it later if you want. But there's one particular part that just couldn't be read. So, pretty R-rated. So let's dive in here. The story of Tamar picks up in chapter 38 of Genesis. It happened at that time that Judah went down from his brothers and settled near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her and went into her. She conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Again she conceived and bore a son, whom she named Onan. Yet again she bore a son, and she named him Shelah. She was in Chezeb when she bore him. All right, so kind of setting the scene. Judah is one of Jacob's 12 sons, and he's really just come off, at least as the narrative goes in Genesis, from selling Joseph down into slavery. So we're not starting in a great place with Judah and his brothers, but he is going to make a life for himself. And he marries this woman, Shua, and has three sons. And this is where Tamar comes in. And as we really get into Tamar, I want you to notice two things, and I'll try and point out some of these. One is, notice the assumptions that are made about Tamar throughout her story. Second, notice the ways Tamar's needs in the story are subordinated to the desires of men. So I want you to notice both of those things as we read through the story. And here's where Tamar comes in. Judah took a wife for his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord put him to death. All right, things just got pretty real. And I want you to know that this is not really a normal thing. The last time we saw that in Genesis was Sodom and Gomorrah, and before that, the flood. This is the first time it's happened to an individual, and we don't know why. But we do know from those two stories that the reason God takes this route in these stories is because these people were inflicting harm, deep harm, on the creation and on others. And so God saw fit, for whatever reason, we don't know. We don't know the story of but we can only assume that he was causing great harm, that God would go this route. And we can only imagine what that was like for Tamar, his wife, to be married to someone who was doing such harm that God would see fit to be rid of him. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her. Raise up offspring for your brother." Now, this seems weird to us, but I want to assure you that it was very normal in this culture and society. It's an institution called levirate marriage, levirate being the Latin for brother-in-law. And this is what would happen. If a firstborn son died and left a widow without a child or an heir, it was the responsibility of the next brother to take that widow as his wife, as long as he was unmarried, to take that widow as his wife and provide an heir for the family. This was good for the family, and it was generally good for the woman. Because Because in this society, there were not a lot of those safety nets. To be an unmarried, and especially a widowed woman in this society, was a very, very vulnerable circumstance. And so it was a way of both providing this heir for the family, but also providing a family and a husband and some security for the widow. Okay? Now, the brother-in-law could say, "I don't want to do that." They could, but not without being dishonored in the eyes of others, because it was the honorable and the right thing to do to take on your brother's widow in this circumstance. But since Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, and this is where I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, he would sleep with Tamar, not once, but many times over, regularly, he would sleep with Tamar, but he would conclude that in a way that would not allow Tamar to be pregnant, where his desires would be fulfilled and her needs would not. This is how Onan chose to go about this situation. And so, in the face of everyone else, he seems like the good, honorable guy, all the while deceiving people. And he benefits from this financially, because as long as he doesn't provide an heir for his brother he's the one who gets not only his inheritance, but his brother's inheritance. And so Onan is a pretty sneaky, deceptive, and demeaning kind of guy. What he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. So we know a little bit more about why that happened. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. Okay, that seems reasonable. She would go back to her family for the time being. That wasn't a long-term solution because life expectancy, right? Eventually she's going to be left alone again. But for now, that seems reasonable until Shelah is grown old enough to be her husband. But then it says, here's why. For he feared that he too, Shelah too, would die like his brothers. I want you to think about that and the assumption that's being made there about Tamar. That somehow she is responsible for the death of Judah's two oldest sons. And isn't that how it often is? We hear a story. We see something happen to a woman. Oh, it couldn't have been my sons, though. Couldn't have been my boys. My boys are... We know that it was because of these boys. It was because of the wickedness of Ur and Onan. But Judah assumes it must be the woman. It must be the wife that is responsible for their deaths. And so he sends her off to her family with no intent of ever providing his third son for her. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. When Judah's time of mourning was over, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hirah the Adullamite. Well, when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she put off her widow's garments, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. Now, at this point, everything points to the fact that what Tamar is doing is just kind of sneaking a peek at what's going on. She hasn't heard from her father-in-law in a while. She's wondering, where's Shelah? You know, where's Judah? What's going on here? And so she covers herself up. Now, in a moment, we're going to see that Judah assumes she's a prostitute. But a veil and being wrapped up was not a sign of that in any culture in this place that we know of at this time. So it seems like she's just disguising herself so she can kind of get a glimpse of what's going on with her in-laws. She saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. And so in this moment, she sees that she has been deceived, that she has been put out to pasture, that she has been left to herself, and not just told that, but made to think that she had prospects and possibilities all for naught. Now, mind you, she still hasn't done anything here, but when Judah saw her, he thought, he assumed her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face, so he didn't recognize her. He went over to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come into you." Ah, romance, right? For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, kind of thinking on the fly here, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" He answered, "I will send you a kid from the flock." And she said, whoa, I need some collateral here. "Only if you give me a pledge until you send it." He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet," which was something that very personal and specific to an individual that would be able to be known that this belonged to Judah. "Your signet and your cord and the staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she got up and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on the garments of her widowhood. When Judah sent the kid, the goat, by his friend, the Adullamite, to recover the pledge, he couldn't find her. He asked the townspeople, "Where is the temple prostitute who is at Enaim by the wayside?" But they said, "No prostitute has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I've not found her." Moreover, the townspeople said, "No prostitute has been here." Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, otherwise we will be laughed at." So He's like, all right, forget it. This only stands to make me look bad, so let's just leave it as it is. About 3 months later, Judah was told, and I imagine it went something, it was kind of like a gossipy thing. Hey, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the whore. Moreover, she's pregnant as a result of her whoredom. It's in the Bible, people. Leave me alone. And Judah said, this is the best part of the story in my mind, bring her out and let her be burned. Boy, see more assumptions, right? As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law. It was the owner of these who made me pregnant. And she said, take note, please, whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. Then Judah acknowledged them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. He did not lie with her again. When the time of her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. And I'll skip some of the interesting parts of the delivery. But she has two sons. The first one is named Perez, and the second is named Zerah. Whew, that's a story, isn't it? With this startling result, really, when Judah says, she is more righteous than I. This woman, who was probably a Canaanite, who may or may not be someone who believes in Yahweh, even having married into the family, they certainly didn't give her any reason to believe in Yahweh, did they? Who is more righteous than one of God's chosen family. And these two, Tamar and Judah, go down as the father and mother of the royal line of Israel. King David, Solomon, Hezekiah, and eventually, of course, Jesus. God's people are not always righteous, but God fills those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, it is no secret that the world's story has not often been kind to women on the whole. So often, men's sins have been overlooked or covered up for the quote-unquote good of the family or the organization or the business or the church. Men often come out looking like the hero, while women are systematically silenced and suppressed by history and oftentimes blamed for whatever goes wrong or whatever indiscretions men might have had. And it would have been the case here too, wouldn't it have, if Tamar hadn't understood the system. She knew she had to do something in order to not fall with the rest of them. That's why she asks for the signet and the cord and the staff. She knows how the system works. But it is not so with the Jesus story. And so Matthew 1 begins prosaically to us, but shockingly, radically, when you understand the story, an account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, by tomorrow. Right in there. Tomorrow's story is lifted up and brought into play. And we know Jesus, that as Jesus walked among us, Jesus welcomed and respected and oftentimes even praised the faith of the women who surrounded him. And amidst Jesus' bumbling band of 12 men, whose name, most of their names we know, but man, if you read these stories, it takes so much for them to get it. It is so often the women who exude faithfulness, who seem to get what Jesus is doing. Which is not to say that women are better than men. Okay, I'll say it. Women are better than men. There you go. Mark it down. But it is to say that God will surely right the wrongs that have been done. Oftentimes, at the hands of men and at the expense of women. Both the individual acts of individual men against individual women and the cultures that have been created to keep these systems in place to diminish and dismiss women. And this making right may happen now, or soon, or in this life. Sometimes these stories, like in Tamar's story, it gets made right in her lifetime. Thanks be to God. And sometimes we'll just have to wait until all things are brought to light. But the sooner it is brought to light, the sooner it can be made right. I should write that down. I just came up with that. The sooner it is brought to light, the sooner it can be made right. Yeah, let's go with that. My favorite part of the story, my second favorite part, I already said favorite part. Favorite insight I gained this week from studying this story was in chapter 38:14, when Tamar put off her widow's garments, put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down. Where she sits down, it says in our text, at the entrance to Enayim. But you know what that means literally in Hebrew? She sat down at the opening of the eyes. It's a great phrase, at the opening of the eyes, because it is God who is the one who opens our eyes. And when our eyes are opened, it can be uncomfortable. Oftentimes our eyes need to be opened to our own sin and the sins of our culture. It also needs to be open to the love and justice of God. And let's not be deceived. For all of God's grace, we still must face the fruit of the seeds that we plant. When God opens our eyes, however, and we see what we have sown, that is the only chance we have to find justice and peace. I would suggest that today our society is going through an opening of the eyes. I personally, I mean, I've obviously known women my whole life, but I have never, as I have through some of the stories that have come out and the proliferation of stories, if you've heard them individually, if you're on social media, it's the hashtag MeToo. But some of the stories have been an opening of the eyes to me. What it's like to be a woman, whether at home or in the workplace, in positions of power, and in positions of powerlessness, and to see the wrongs that have systematically been covered up over the years, even to see some of the wrongs that I have perpetrated, knowingly or unknowingly. When people yearn for a simpler day, back in the day when things were simpler. It's these stories that make me cringe. On behalf of those who have been done harm in order to keep those days simpler. Shh, don't tell your story. It'll just complicate things. So this morning I have a different message for men and for women. It's not because men and women are of different value in the eyes of God. It is because men and women are treated differently and have different experiences in our society. First, to the women among us, I encourage you to continue to hunger and thirst for righteousness. This is the story of Tamar. A woman who hungered and thirsted that things would be made right. And it is not for me to tell you what stories you should tell or shouldn't tell or when you should or shouldn't tell those stories. But I encourage you to hunger and thirst for righteousness, to persist and to have courage. That God is making and will make all things right, as difficult as it may be in the moment to face those stories and realities. Men, I also want to encourage us to hunger and thirst for righteousness, but it looks different for us. What that means, it means that we must examine ourselves, allow our eyes to be open, to see the assumptions that we have made about women. To have our eyes open to the ways that we may have put our desires ahead of women's needs, or simply benefited from a society that gives men opportunities that are denied to women, and holds women to other standards than to which we are held. We must have our eyes open to face our cultures that have been set up to protect and heroize men as they silence and diminish women. Generally, on the whole. And again, the key here is that the wrongs must come to light to be healed. Eyes must be opened. We will reap what we sow. If we want to cling to an ignorance is bliss mentality, we will fail to experience Jesus' kingdom of justice and peace and joy. And finally, a reminder to all of us that if this messy story can get written into the Jesus story, there is not a messy story among us that cannot be brought to light and healed and redeemed. Whether you have been wronged or wronged another, or probably both, may we trust that God is making all things right, that God is putting to death the sins of this world on Jesus' cross and burying them in Jesus' tomb and raising us with Jesus to live lives that are forgiven, with eyes open to the image of God in all people and the inherent principle that all people are to be loved and not used. And that whatever our story is, whatever our family stories and secrets may be, God is not ashamed to call us the family of God. Sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, as our stories, like Judah and Tamar, become grafted into the story of God's grace, the story of Jesus. May we find our messy stories in the story of Tamar and of Judah. May our eyes be open to the world as it is, and may our souls hunger and thirst for the world that God desires.